Welcome to the latest United Week Stand podcast. My name is Andy Mitten and I'm delighted to welcome Chris Casper as our guest today. Chris is a Burnley lad. He's 38. He was a youth player at Manchester United and he played with all the lads who did really well, the class of 92. Played twice for the first team. He went on loan to Bournemouth. He went on loan to Swindon Town. He went to Reading. He ended up signing full-time for Reading in 1998. And playing 39 games there. He was an England under 18 international. He played once for England under 21s and then he moved into management. Team Bath, he had good success there, and then he moved to Bury, not far from where he's from. I'm sure he'll fill us in on all the details. And he's the son of the former Burnley forward and manager, I think, Frank Casper. Welcome, Chris. Thanks for coming on.
Morning, Andy. You're welcome.
Yeah. What are you doing with yourself these days?
I work for the Premier League in the youth department. We've changed the system recently with the Elite Player Performance Plan. My job is to work with a cluster of clubs and move this plan forward. It's something that's needed to be done over the last 15 years. We needed to get more homegrown players into the Premier League, and this is the starting point of it, really. It's a long-term project. But we have to make a start somewhere, and basically the academies have been categorised into four different categories. And like I said, hopefully this will lead to more homegrown players playing in the Premier League.
So this will be, United and City would have the elite academy status, and a lot of the bigger clubs, but if you look at a slightly smaller club with a good youth record, someone like Ipswich Town, I think when they got academy status, it was a big deal for them. They saw it as almost as a safeguard to their future talent rather than losing their promising youngsters to bigger clubs. Is that right? And can you tell us a bit more how it works?
Yeah, I mean, it's not about the bigger clubs cherry-picking off the smaller clubs or anything like that. It's about the bigger clubs developing what they've already got. As far as an elite environment's concerned, you look at Manchester City, Manchester United, their academies are getting bigger and bigger. They're getting better and better as well, hopefully. With the addition of staff, the facilities, more contact hours with the players that we've unlocked through the education programme as well, that allows the players to come out of school and train more often. So, we've looked at a lot of elite environments throughout sport, whether that be, tennis, we've looked at the Royal Ballet, we've looked at other European European leagues and things like that. So, there's been a lot of research goes on, and hopefully the fruition will come through. It's not going to be a short-term fix. It's going to be a long-term plan, but the process has already started and moving forward.
Does it depress you how few homegrown players make it into Premier League sides, especially young English players?
It is at the minute. Like I say, over the last 10 years, I think that figure's dropped dramatically to something like 33%. Over the last couple of years, we have already noticed an upturn in that. So I think the plan is, starting to evolve, we're starting to work, and hopefully in the next, 5 to 10 years, we'll notice a big improvement. It took Germany an awful long time for their plan to develop from the European Championships in 2000, where, they had very few homegrown players in the Bundesliga, or should I say the under-21s in the German National League. The German National Team, I think there was one. I think by 2010 there was seven under-21s in that team. So, it is for the Premier League, but hopefully it's for the good of the game as well, and the National Team will see the benefits of it.
So, where are you based?
I'm based in the North West.
Did you see the story with your old friends Gary Neville and Ryan Giggs being linked with Salford City? I don't know how true it is or not, and I'll speak to them about it, but the one point that they seem to be making was there's a lack of players coming up through non-league football like you would have seen in the past.
Yeah, I think that's probably because the recruitment strategies of the clubs now, they are basically every player in the country will be getting tracked and will be getting seen. Whereas in the past, there'll be, the odd diamond, like a Les Ferdinand or a Ian Wright or someone like that, who will fall through the net. Yeah. But these days, that won't happen. So, that's probably the reason why that figure is quite low now. Yeah. You know, the recruitment strategies and processes for the, from the clubs is absolutely outstanding, even right down to the younger age groups of, you know, you look at someone like a United who's got 20-odd development centres throughout the North West. Manchester City will be getting the same. Liverpool have got an awful lot as well. So all these kids are getting watched now. So that's why I think it's probably quite low.
My littlest brother's 6 years old and he'd been asked to trial at Everton and then United and then City. He's 6 years old. And my dad said no to the Everton one. And the reason he said it was because, and he played as a footballer himself, my other younger brother had a very good career in non-league football, playing semi-pro. The highest level was Altrincham for 13 years. But our other brother, he was also at United. Then he went to Stockport and he was in that system. And he was at a club which fell apart and he didn't make it for many reasons. And my dad was a little bit cynical to the way that clubs hoover up all the talent and a lot of dreams tend to get wrecked. Is that just part of the process? It's a statistical process where you might bring in 1,000 players and only one or two of them will make it. Has that always been the way, or is the net being cast wider now?
I think it's always been the way, Andy. I think, you know, even right back to when I was recruited, you know, you used to go down to the holiday training sessions at the Cliff, and there'd be hundreds and hundreds of kids there.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't the fact that, you know, you were picked as a 14-year-old to say, right, you know, you will become an apprentice at Manchester United. You've got an awful lot to do.
Yeah.
You know, so it has always been going on. But I think now, the amount of staff that clubs have got, the amount of investment that they're putting into these academies and, you know, what they're looking to get from the returns of those academies, is a massive operation, and it's competitive, and you want it competitive, you want it to drive standards up. So, you know, hopefully every young player in the country is getting seen, you know, and hopefully out of that comes a top class international player who is playing who is capable of playing at a really high standard in the Premier League.
You grew up in Burnley, your dad was a football man. What was childhood like?
Indifferent. It was good when, because basically the school that I went to, St Theodore's in Burnley, was a stone's throw from the football ground. And as you know, Burnley's a very, very passionate town for football. I think per person in the town, it's the most well supported club in the country. You know, I think it's something like 80,000 people in the town, and they're averaging, you know, 15,000-16,000 gates. So, I thought neither of one in four people is going to watch the football. It was a really, it was a bit of a difficult time, I've got to admit, but, you know, my dad went from being the assistant manager at Bury, which was, you know, a really good club, but, you know, kept themselves to themselves and was progressing well through the leagues, and then all of a sudden he got the manager's job. I think I was in my third year at, so it would be year nine now, at senior school, and all of a sudden I got quite a lot of attention and a lot of focus on my dad's job, which, you know, it was difficult to handle at times because the start of his reign wasn't very successful. And kids being kids, they do pinpoint things out and they can be quite cruel at times. So
what did he say to you? We had Andy Cole on one of the podcasts and he was saying that people had have a go at his son because his dad had missed a chance the day before.
Yeah, he'd come on, if Burnley got beat on Saturday, you know, his dad's hopeless and he's, you know, he can't do this, and why is he doing that? And I've got to be honest with you, it was mainly the younger kids. The lads in my year were great, and to be fair, the older lads were like, well, you know, it's not his fault. But, you know, one of the two of the more naive 10, 11 and 12-year-olds took a bit of an opportunity to have a go, and at times, obviously, you've got to stick up for yourself and fight back, and not as much fight back, but every now and then just put one or two people in the place.
So you're a young lad, promising young footballer. How did you get noticed by United?
Yeah, I was playing for Burnley Town team at under-14s. And the old manager, Joe Brown, was the scout at United. And the sports my dad invited me to go along to trials. And like I said, the week's training at the Cliff and Littleton Road. Fortunately, they tracked me. And when I was 15, I was offered a 2-year scholarship and a 2-year professional contract as well. So I'd got offers from other clubs to go on trial at Spurs and Aston Villa, Notts Forest as well. But you know, when United offer you that kind of a you know, a future, then I didn't want to really want to go anywhere else.
Are you a captain of England's youth team?
Yeah, under 18s. We had a really good team, though. I've got to be honest with you. We had a fantastic all-round team. You know, with Sol Campbell, obviously Gary was in there, Kevin Sharp, who was playing regular for Leeds United. Mark Tinkler was playing regular. Nicky, obviously, Scholesy. Up front, we got Robbie Fowler and Julian Joachim. You know, so we've got a fantastic team, and we eventually went on to win the European Championships, beating some good teams as well, Spain, France, and Holland, before beating Turkey in the final.
Nicky's agreed to come on this podcast, and I did an interview with him for one of my books, and he was telling me about his teammates, and he said, you've got to get this in print with Paul Scholes. Everyone thinks he's a nice, unassuming lad. He's the driest, most sarcastic bastard I have ever played with. What were them lads like? And I know that you've had great relationships and friendships with all of them, but tell us something we don't know about some of them. You know, Gary Neville, who can hold his own in an argument. Nicky, Scholesy, Beck, some of the other lads. What were your memories of that time? And did you see the Class of 92 film?
Yeah, we went down to the premiere. It was interesting, and I thought the lads came across really well.
Me too.
Really, how they are. I mean, with all respect, as a 16-year-old, there was only ever going to be one superstar come out of that team, and that was Ryan Giggs.
Yeah.
You know, even as a 14-year-old, you could see what Ryan was going to become. Just everything about him, his movement, his quality, his pace, his skill. You know, there's only one person ever going to play, go on to do what Ryan was going to do, and you know, fulfil his potential. But you know, the other lads, Gary's a bit nervous when he first started. I think he first came across Gary playing in the under 15s Burnley Town team. He was playing, we were playing Bury under 15s Town team, and I knew Gary from Lancashire cricket trials and things like that, and whatever. So and Gary was on the bench for Bury under 15s Town team, which, you know, 2 years later, he's captain in Manchester United's youth team. So that just probably just goes to show what kind of a character he is. But a little bit nervous to begin with early on, and a bit of a worry is Gary. You know, he's doesn't like it a little bit to worry about. And can argue as well. I once had an argument with him for about 4 days in on a tournament, and we just weren't backing down. We both thought we were right, and I can be quite argumentative as well. And closed-minded, I suppose, and we were arguing about a goal in the FA Cup final in 1993, and I didn't think the keeper should have been blamed for the goal. He thought the keeper should have had a strip tore off him in the dressing room after, and we were both just, you know, slaughtering each other, saying how ridiculous each other were, and telling each other to shut up all the time.
I can relate to it. Gone on a little longer than 3 days with him, but I'm gonna see him next month. Hopefully, he'll come on here at some point in the future. But a serious point there, to go from being on the bench for a town team to captaining Manchester United, that's a hugely driven young man.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, he's, you know, that's the kind of lad he is, and it was an amazing transformation, really. You know, to go from that level and not really seeing him again for 18 months, and then he turned up at United on a first day of pre-season. We knew each other a little bit. And that was the thing about the dressing room. I didn't really know many people. You know, the lads had grown up together, but I'd been on trials and whatever, and a few training camps and that. But lads were playing regular together. Nicky, Scholesy, Gary, John King, Carl Brown.
Yeah.
They were all playing for...
Boundary Park. Yeah.
So that must have been some team that.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't want to play. And to be fair, I was in midfield, and playing against Butty and Carl Brown was awful. It was like the Cray twins, honestly.
When
they would tackle their own granny, honestly. Butty, Carl Brown was a fantastic little player.
Yeah.
It was really unfortunate that he picked up a really serious injury in, I think, one of the first games in pre-season against Aston Villa. I think he broke his ankle really badly, but Carl was a fantastic little player as well. Very aggressive, really good on the ball, lovely lad off the pitch, but he aggressive little lad, Brownie, yeah.
Nicky talked quite a lot about him. What was Nicky like?
Nicky was I'm not sure saying Nicky's not grown up, but Nicky's how he's always been, like he is now. It changed Nicky when he went on the pitch. Off the pitch, he's quite messed about a little bit and likes to laugh and a joke, and he can be wound up pretty easily, but gotta be honest. But put him on the pitch, he becomes a real calm figure, a leader. Not much rattled him. I think Dennis Wise once got him sent off in a game against Chelsea, but that was about it, really. Nicky was always under control. And as a 16-year-old, Nicky, I think, got into the first team, maybe 17. He was a mature build for his age. He thought, well, he's got his opportunity. How he will do. It wasn't ever like Ryan, where Ryan got put in and you knew he was just going to burst in the start, into stardom. Nicky went in and did a good job, played against Gothenburg, I think he came on or played against them and really just settled into the team really quickly, but off the pitch is a little bit different,
I went to see Roberto Di Matteo at his house just before Christmas, and I asked him, Dennis Wise, is he the nutter everyone says he is? And he replied, Wise is crazy in a good way. He's a good friend and we keep in touch. We've spent a lot of our life together. He was a good captain, very fair in that he put emphasis on the squad, not only the important players. He was crazy on the pitch, though. He would drive the opposition nuts by winding them up. He got Nicky Butt sent off. He wound him up that much. He'd talk, he'd pinch them. He was great to have in your team. And I don't think Roberto knew that I was a Manchester United fan, but I can remember that with Nicky. That was the one time that he let himself go a little bit. But he had a fantastic career and he's doing well now on the coaching side at United. What about the other lads, Bex?
Yeah, Bex was... he's not really changed. We used to have a nickname for him. He was Pretty Boy, or Charlie, who come from London.
Yeah.
And to be fair, he settled in really well. It was a different culture for him and way of life and whatever. But, liked his nice things in life, did David.
What like? When he was 7, 18?
Yeah, you go away on a tour, and the lads would just take the wash bag and, the deodorant, the shampoo, whatever. He'd take his aftershave, he'd take all his moisturisers and line them all up, and, all his clothes would be really, really tidy, and all his part of the room would be spotless and that, and he couldn't have it any other way. He always liked the nice thing. But a really good lad, genuine lad. Even now, he's gone on to become an absolute superstar. He really has, and fair play to him. And I think that, that was always his motivation. Some players are motivated by winning titles. Some players are motivated by having their name sung by the Stretford. David wanted that stardom, I think, and he's got that. And if he didn't want it, then he'd do what Scholesy did. Also what Scholesy's done, and keep himself to himself, keep quiet in the media. But Scholesy in the dressing room is very, very lively. But like Nicky says, he's dry, got a really good sense of humour, and really genuine lad as well. But David, he's got the superstar wife, he's got the superstar life. He's now just bought a massive club in America. So well played to him, fair play to him. He's done everything that he wanted to do. And also, as well, I've got to say, his love for the game was absolutely unbelievable. His practice, and his dedication to his work. People think that, these lads have just, they achieved what they achieved just, because we were just thrown together and whatever. It wasn't. We were all dedicated to, and some people more successful than others and reached different levels. But the amount of work and the practice that we put in was, and that was led by Eric Harrison.
Yeah.
But that was instilled in you. And I suppose from the gaffer as well, from Sir Alex, that you practice and you get out of life what you put into it. And David's definitely done that.
And the other lads, and I remember interviewing Giggsy in early 1996, and he was so relieved that Beckham had come through because it took all the attention away from him and in terms of the spotlight. And it was like, David wants that. I'm happy. I'm happy just to play football. What was Giggsy like?
Yeah, he's a good lad. Ryan is he's got a wicked sense of humour. Mm. You know, he can look after himself as well. By the way, he can do that. Mm. But yeah, he's a good lad. Really, he's like I say, he's probably, I think Phil Neville called him the most grounded superstar in the country, I suppose.
Yeah.
You know, he's like that. He's, you know, what he's achieved has been absolutely phenomenal. All them league titles, the European Cups, and you know all the accolades that's gone with it. But he's still a really grounded lad, and never forgot his roots, never forgot his family and his friends and that, and you know, you get what you see from Ryan, I suppose, and I say what a fantastic player and a career he's had.
Phil Neff.
I think Scholes and Butty kind of wound him up a little bit, and you know, I think one of the stories in the class of 92 is he ended up putting him in a rubbish bin outside living room, which just about sums it up really. But a good quality player. I mean, I think the problem maybe with Phil is that he was good in two or three positions. You know, as a left back he was excellent, could play as a central midfielder, could play as a right back. Probably one of the most, with him and Ben Thornley, the most gifted two-footed players I've ever seen. You know, you wouldn't know what footed they were. You know, if you put them on the right, they could play equally as well on the right or on the left. And maybe that was a little bit of Phil's downfall, really, that he couldn't, you know, it was not through any fault of his own. But, you know, when it came to the big games, you know, Dennis would play and then Gary would play, the central midfielder, Roy and Scholes. So, you know, maybe his Man United career didn't take off as much as it might have done when he first got in the team, because I think Sir Alex picked him in his best 11 over the first 10 years of his tenure, or 15 years or something like that.
Yeah, he did.
But, you know, it didn't last, because, you know, he was used in quite a few positions and never really nailed one down, I suppose.
What was Roy Keane like as your captain? We spoke to lots of lads who said he was an absolutely brilliant player, but he was so hard on players. What was he like with
Roy? Roy was fierce.
Yeah.
You know, some of the things that he said to lads, it was strong, I suppose, but that was his standard. The thing is that if you come out with things like that and you don't back it up, you're made to look a clown.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, when Roy said something, he'd then go out and prove what everybody else should be doing. So, as far as leadership was concerned, he was outstanding at that. You know, and I think maybe one of Roy's, not failures, but, you know, something that he couldn't quite handle was the ability of other players that just weren't as good as him.
Mm.
And maybe now he's, you know, he's starting to realise that. He's got a really good job in Ireland, where he'll be learning from Martin O'Hill, I'm sure. And, you know, he was a fantastic leader. As a player, you couldn't wish to play with a better player. He's got pace, his quality on the ball, he could score goals, especially in his younger days when he was a box-to-box player. I think he had a hip injury towards the end of his career, which maybe just held him back a little bit. But as far as the dynamic midfielder was concerned, I couldn't think of anybody over the last, you know, 30 years who was, you know, he was as good as Roy. So, you know, he couldn't pay him a higher compliment than that. In training, he was the same, set really high standards. And if you were sloppy, then he told you no uncertain terms, which you appreciate, you know, and he all makes mistakes and whatever. And if you give the ball away through trying to try something, then that was fine. But if you were sloppy, then you were told about it. I suppose Roy took on that the manager's philosophy, I suppose, onto the pitch. You know, the manager didn't really say much in training. He didn't have to, because the players set the standards themselves, and probably Roy set that high standard. You know, but the players set the standards in the training, so the training was always a really high tempo, and the manager didn't have to. You know, he got good coaches, put on really good sessions, high tempo sessions, everything that the lads needed. But when the lads went onto the pitch and played games, then I suppose Roy was, you know, what the instilled into the lads, what the manager wanted to get across to them, I suppose.
Did he ever have a go at you?
Not really, no. I always got on really well with Roy. I think, I suppose my character is that I used to train how I played anyway, so I suppose, you know, if you give the ball away, you'd get a bit of a chill, I suppose. But no, invariably, I got on pretty well with Roy, because I like that, you know, you tell it how you how you see it. So, you know, if you are sloppy, I can't stand sloppiness. Mm. That winds me up as well. And, you know, when I was a coach and a manager, I wouldn't stand for anything like that. Mm. So I suppose we've got kind of the same values, just that Roy was a better player than me, and far better player than me.
You made your debut in the famous League Cup tie against Port Vale in 1994. You actually made it in the second leg at Old Trafford rather than the game at Villa Park, if I'm not mistaken. What do you remember about your debut for Manchester United? 31,000 people, 2-0 win against Port Vale.
Yeah, I'd been injured leading up to the game. In the pre-season, I was fine, to be fair. I played at Rangers, although it wasn't a great performance from us, but I was on that tournament against Rangers. I think we played Newcastle as well.
Yeah, I was at that. I remember going up to Ibrox for that one.
Yeah, when Eric got sent off
yeah.
for a 2-foot tackle, which wasn't great on Stephen Presley, but then I went to Ireland on a pre-season tour as well with the first team. So I was in and around the first team. I was flying, and then I picked up an ankle injury. It kept me out for about 5 or 6 weeks and really, you know, messed my ankle ligaments up. And even then, I went in. I knew the lads were getting chances in that Port Vale game. I wasn't fit for the first game. I was nowhere near. Even the second game, I wasn't great going into it. But I wanted to play. You know, all the lads were getting chances, and I got through it. I did okay. I remember Brian McClair scoring. When if he wouldn't have scored, I maybe tapped it in the far post. You know, so it was a decent enough game. I seem to remember a collision of heads with Lee Glover, I think, had a bit of a mess of his nose and whatever, which defended on the far post. But apart from that, there wasn't much else in the game. It was a, you know, a pretty comfortable night for us, really, against a decent team. Yeah. But I think seem to remember the manager got a bit of stick for playing a young team and disrespecting the competition when the teams were announced, or when he was suggesting he was going to play a week in Team Port Vale.
Yeah, it was from the lady who gave him stick was the local MP in Burslem, in Stoke. And she said it was disrespectful that the people were paying good money to go and watch a load of kids. Now, she was wrong on several points. One, Port Vale fans supported their team regardless, and she just thought that United should be the circus coming into town. And two, the young kids destroyed them.
I mean, the one thing that was never going to happen was the manager was never going to, you know, send a group of lads out to tarnish the name of Manchester United. I mean, if we'd have got smashed 5, you know, that would have been a disrespect. There's no question about it. She might have had a point after that, but the manager had the trust and, you know, the know-how in the players to make sure that was never going to be the case. Mm. You know, so there were two decent games. They were good games, competitive games.
Scholesy, what was he like?
What's that, sorry?
Scholesy played. He'd made his debut, I think, in the game at Vale Park. What
Scholesy,
was the
score? 94, so we were just second year pros. Scholesy, again, was one of these. He was a late developer, really. As a first-year apprentice, Scholesy never played, or hardly played and hardly trained, especially in the first 6 months. He's got problems with his knees, I think, or one of his knees, osteolateral, something like that. So, you know, and you begin to wonder, you're looking at him, small kid, not really, you know, developed or anything like that, sitting on the side, and you think, you know, what's he doing, really, like, you know, but the club saw a lot in him, a lot of potential in him, and you know, he was a late developer, and that was Scholesy's season when he burst onto the scene, really, you know, when he played against Port Vale. Before that, he was a very, very good player, you know, there's no question, but in that year, I seem to think that you could really tell he was starting to make a difference, even affecting the first team. That game really worked for Scholesy, there's no question about that.
John O'Kane played, good player. I once tracked him down to interview him, and he was such a nervous lad. He did the interview, and he was very pleasant, but I don't think I've ever come across... Maybe he was just scared of the media, but why didn't it work out for John?
John's the first to admit that, I don't know, maybe it was his attitude or, you know, his focus and whatever. I think out of all the lads in our group, you know, not including Ryan, John was probably the most talented, especially as a defender. He was outstandingly quick, strong, very good in the air, read the game really well, you know, his quality on the ball. He could play as easily play as a central midfielder. You know, but for whatever reason, I don't know why it didn't quite happen for Johnny. He had one or two opportunities and went on to have a decent career, you know, at Everton, and I think he went to Bolton and Burnley and whatever. So, you know, I don't know, maybe it was a mindset thing with John, and, you know, he definitely got the potential to go on to succeed and become, you know, a really top player. But for whatever reason, sometimes, you know, it might be the opportunity or whatever, just didn't quite work for him. And, you know, there's a lot of people that happens to. But John was top draw, yeah.
Another player in that team when you made your debut was Simon Davies. When I was a junior footballer in Manchester, the best three players in my league were Ryan Wilson, a lad called AD Mike, who was at City, and Simon Davies. I think Simon played 10 times for United. He's not someone who's remembered. He works at City now. Was he a good player?
Yeah, he was excellent, Shaky. Yeah, he was maybe just lacked half a yard of pace. But again, really good quality on the ball, outstanding on the ball. Could run all day as well, fit as anything. And, you know, I've got opportunities. Again, it didn't quite work out for him. He's got on the left-hand side and midfield. He's got Ryan, he's got Lee Sharp, and then you go and sign Jesper Blomqvist and people like that. So maybe he found opportunities a little bit difficult. But, you know, he's gone on. I think he moved on to Luton, I think, or somewhere like that. But he's gone on now to have a really good career as a coach, which probably wasn't in Simon's nature when he was... He was a little bit carefree when he was younger. You know, and you thought, you know, coaching would definitely, if out of the lads who was going to be a good coach, Simon probably wouldn't be one of them. But he's gone on, he's recognised what his strengths are, and he's gone on to have a really good career as a coach. And he's got an outstanding job now at Man City. So, fair play to him. It's not all about what you do in your career as a footballer. Sometimes it doesn't always work out. It's how you respond to that, and Sam has done that. He's done really well for himself.
You find opportunities difficult yourself?
Yeah, I did, yeah. You know, like I say, getting into the 94 team on tour. I was on the bench for the Charity Shield as well against Blackburn.
Yeah.
And then getting the injury. The lads just flew from... You know, the start of 94, that held me back up to Christmas, I suppose. And then, you know, finding the opportunity to come, you know, Ronnie Johnson was signed, obviously Yap Stam, Henningberg. So it was always going to be, a difficult one through the fucking trying or anything. I still worked as hard, but not everybody can be successful, I suppose. I made the most of what I'd got. I'm 5'11", 12 stone, can't really run that quick.
Yeah.
Not great in the air, but played... I played 6 or 7 times for United with the cup competitions and the league and everything. So, try and make the most of what I've got, and you know, that was probably as successful as it could be.
So, you went on loan to several clubs. What was your thinking then? You're not going to make it at the top level, make a decent career at a lower level like your dad had done?
But in all fairness, I played in the first division for Burnley, so
I'd
have had as good a career as he would have done. And he got injured when he was 28, otherwise he'd have probably been in the England, he was in the England squad, but got injured in a nasty tackle off Norman Hunter at Leeds, which wasn't very good. The plan to me was a bit like Beggs, I suppose. Beggs went to Preston in 94, he went on loan for a month and came back a different player, and I went to Bournemouth in January 96. I was still only 20, so you think, well, you know, get some first team experience, and then I might start to affect the first team, more and more. And I did. I came back. I was in the European Cup semi final. Was on the bench actually in Dortmund, Monaco, in the quarter final in '96, I think. Made my first team debut, so it did work for me to a certain degree, but it just couldn't quite hold down a regular spot. But it did give me an opportunity to see what first team football was like. It was good. I had 15 games, I think, 16 games at Bournemouth. And like I say, came back and I was a different player, I suppose. You know, it really did work for me. And then I went out to Swindon in 97 as well, which was another level because we were in the championship. It was the championship, or it would be the championship there, and we were top of the league.
Yeah.
So every game was a really big game, and after 2 months, I got called back. But we were top of the league. Yeah. So I made some really good performances there as well. So again, that worked for me.
And then you went to Reading and you ended up signing full time for Reading. You had a few good years there.
Yes, signing, went on loan in 98, September 98, signed contract in November. I had a good year, and then Boxing Day 99, that was the end of my career.
Yeah.
I just went into a tackle. Well, it wasn't so much a tackle, I thought it was a tackle, somebody else thought it was a little bit different. And basically, I finished my career with a two-footed lunge, basically, which even to this day is still difficult to get your head round and, you know, talk about. But
who was it?
Life and it happens. But
who made the lunge?
Sorry.
Who made the lunge?
It was a player called Richard Carpenter.
Yeah.
It was a Boxing Day. It was all the, you know, the. You always think it was a Boxing Day, it was a Sunday, it was a 12 o'clock kickoff. We were away at Cardiff when I was playing for Reading and I was just back defending the corner. I'd got the corner for us. I was back on the halfway line and the counter pushed the ball through one of our lads' legs just outside the box and I'd come onto the ball and was sliding to intercept the ball and basically just lunged at me and lunged over the ball and smashed my leg in half and injured my ankle and, you know, snap my knee as well at the same time. So it was a pretty difficult thing physically, but also mentally as well. It was really tough to come back from. It was a really tough time in my life. I was fortunate that I had, you know, support of, you know, a really strong wife next to me and family and that. So, but it was tough, I've got to be honest.
Did you have any dealings with the player after? Did he apologise? There wasn't any legal action like Ben had or anything like that?
Apparently he came to see me in the hospital, but I was sedated and drugged up and all that with, you know, painkillers and that. So I think my dad intercepted him halfway up and asked him in no uncertain terms to leave because he wasn't welcome, because it was a stupid, irresponsible, reckless tackle. There was no need for it, you know, and there was only one person going to win out of that tackle, and it wasn't going to be me.
Yeah.
So there was no need for it. You know, and those are the kind of things that, you know, just wreck your career, they wreck your life as well. You know, all the emotional things that you go through, all the off-field stuff, you know, it's the mental side of it is really tough. I'm good friends. We just joined the Premier League, Paul Lake. Paul went through a similar thing with his knees, or with his knee injury. I think he wrote a book about it, I think.
His book's brilliant. His book is
absolutely
brilliant. I told him, it's absolutely brilliant. You know, even as a United fan reading it, it's just... It's very sad, and he talks about what you alluded to, the mental side of things being very difficult for him. What was your lowest point?
There's that many that, you know, when you're in the hospital and the hospital and they're telling you that, you know, your bones aren't fixed, you're going to need a bone graft, you're going to be another 10 months. You know, and the hardest part as well is probably the realisation that you're not going to get back playing, you're not affecting the first team. I played with it, I played a couple of reserve games, the leg was still broken, the fibula was still broken. They say it's a non-weight bearing bone, but people who say that, I've never had a football blasted against a, you know, a broken leg, so the pain is absolutely ridiculous. Even, you know, twisting in bed, you know, moving around and stuff like that, the pain was excruciating, and those are really, you know, low moments, you know, when you realise that. And I'd not made a decision to retire or anything like that. It was just one day, it just came to me. I was at the training ground, we've got a game coming up Friday morning, and it just dawned on me that, you know, I couldn't do it anymore. And I just walked off the pitch and said to the manager, it was Alan Pardew, Gaffer, I'm going to have to go in. He said, "You all right?" And I said, "Nah, I can't do this anymore." He said, "Well, I'll give you a call after," and that was it. I got in my car and drove away. And you know, it wasn't a long, something that I thought about, a deliberation or anything like that. That's how quickly it happened. It just dawned on me that I wasn't never going to get back to where I was. And I tried. That was That was 2.5 years later. That after the tackle, so it wasn't just a quick reaction. You know, 3 or 4 months after this, it was 2.5 years of trying to get back fit, trying. In the end, I needed a bone graft, which was going to keep me out for nearly another year. I've got a young family. It wasn't affecting the first team, and that was it. You know, I made the decision to stop it there and then.
And then a couple of years later, put ITV on and up your pop as manager of Team Bath, someone I'd never heard of, and suddenly you're in the FA Cup.
Well, actually, when I was rehabbing from the injury, because I was just waiting for the bones to fix, I live near Bath, and instead of travelling all the way down to Reading just to use the gym there, basically, I spoke to Jed Roddy and Paul Tisdale, Jed was the director of sport at Team Bath, at Bath University, and Paul was kind of like the first team coach of the Bath University and Team Bath that were located in the same place. So I said, you know, can I come along and use the gym facilities and whatever, and yeah, you know, I spoke to them about it. So basically, as soon as I finished playing, I spoke to them about doing some coaching. I got straight back into it and got on the training ground and started doing my coaching badges when I was 26, 27. So, and then 18 months later, yeah, we had a good team, all university lads as well, and got, I think we won more games in that competition in that year than the winners Arsenal, because you've got to go through qualifying competitions and, you know, all the preliminary rounds and stuff like that, and we end up winning more games than the winners. So that was a real fantastic, you know, experience as well. And the university where we played the game against Mansfield was where we held the game. You know, it was at the university. We put up temporary stands. There was 6,000 fans there.
I can remember it, yeah.
Sky, it was live on Sky, and it was a fantastic, thing for the lads to do. They were excellent. So yeah, that was a decent point in my life, but still not the same as playing in the cup.
And then you worked into coaching, and you managed at Bury.
Yeah, I moved back up. In 2003, I was a long way away from my family, who were, you know, I'm really close to, and my wife Karen's really close to her family. So, I decided to look for a coaching job up here, and fortunately, when I did move up, I got offered the youth team coaching job at Bury. Bury's always been a close club to me because, like I said before, my dad was the manager to Martin Dobson for 4 years in the early 80s, and it's a fantastic little club, say little, you know, in the eyes of the supporters, it's a massive club, and rightly so. But when you look at the other clubs around it and the competition that they've got, you know, they've got to have something about them to survive and do what they continue to do. And that's a culture that they've got at the club that's really close knit. The people work far and away beyond the hours they probably get paid for. And that's the kind of club it is. It's a very, very friendly, open club. And even in the mid 90s, I think end up in the Championship. So it's done well to carry on succeeding as it's done. So it was always close to my heart was the club, and to get the opportunity to work there was great. And then 2 years later, unfortunately, Graham Barrow got the sack after 10 games, I think it was, and he'd had, I think in those 10 games, 6 of the games were against the top 6 teams who ended up getting promoted, got in the playoffs or went up automatically. It was a really tough run. And after 10 games, he'd only won one game, and we got 6 points. So we were 3 or 4 points adrift at the bottom of the league, and got asked to take the team for the game on Saturday. But I said, you know, I'm like, yeah, I'll take the team, but I don't want the job. And the director that spoke to me was like, right, okay. Looked at me a little bit puzzled, and I thought to myself on the way home, you know, and spoke to my dad, I haven't said that, like, you know, and I might not get another opportunity. The new manager was coming in, might want to bring his own youth team coaching as well, because I enjoy taking the youth team. It's a, you know, really good experience for me. A rewarding experience. So I did turn it around pretty quick and said, look, you know, I've probably been a bit naive there. You know, if the job is available, then I'll interview for the job. And I had 2 interviews for it and had a decent run with we had some good results in that period of time when I was caretaker manager, and fortunately I got the job.
And then what happened?
A 2.5 year, good years.
Yeah.
We avoided relegation in the first year. Again, sold our main asset, Simon Whaley, to Preston.
Yeah.
When we sold Simon, I think we were eighth in the league and really could have pushed on towards the playoffs. Mm. Unfortunately, you sell your best player and you don't replace them. And that's how the club has survived as well. They've had to sell the best players, and you know the money doesn't always get reinvested into the playing side. So we finished the season. We finished it strong, to be fair. Ended up getting Casper Schmeichel on loan and one or two other good lads. John Daly, who's now, I think, playing for Rangers now, John. Lewis Goulburn, and obviously Casper, he was outstanding. I think we ended up losing one out of the last 10 games and avoided relegation. And the next year, we were doing well up to Christmas. I think we set a club record, 6 out of 6 wins. We're on a really good roll. Again, you sell your best player, Mattis, midfielder. He was outstanding for us, goal scoring, box to box midfielder. They're not easy to replace. Sell him to Barnsley, and it has an effect on the team. Again, you've got to react to it, pull a few rabbits out of hats, and you know, speak to one or two contacts that you've got down the line. Get some loan players in, finish the season quite strong, and you know, in a decent position. So that was the first couple of years, and then they brought a director of football in to work with me, Keith Alexander.
Mm.
God rest his soul. Keith is a lovely fella, but our football beliefs were miles off, basically. You know, I wanted to play, you know, pass from the back, and we couldn't always do that, obviously. But you know, I always wanted to play football. That had been instilled in me from the Manchester United days. Keith was a little bit more direct, you could say. And it was a really strange situation, very, very difficult, and they ended up leaving in January, although left the club in the third round replay of the FA Cup. The first time we got into the third round of the Cup for 7 years, we drew at Norwich in the first game, and then the week after we lost at Darlington, and I got sacked on the Monday, the day before the replay against Norwich on the Tuesday, which the club went on to win. So that was a bit disappointing, really, the way it ended, because, you know, financially, it's always been the motive at Bury, it has to be.
Yeah.
You know, you want to be successful, but financially, as long as you've still got a football club in the football league, that's a success.
Yeah.
You know, and the money we'd earned from the cup run against, you know, in the FA Cup, we'd had a really good run in the Johnson's Paints. We'd beat Leeds away as well in front of 25,000 people. So the money from the gate receipts and everything that can't be budgeted for is extra revenue for them. You know, probably worked out as maybe between £500,000 to £600,000. So you're looking for, you know, 25% of that. If you can reinvest some of that money into the playing side of things, then you can really kick on. We were halfway up the league, and you know, two or three good, decent results would have been in the playoffs. But unfortunately, you know, people get above the station a little bit too. They expect too much because you've had a bit of success, and then you know you have a bit of a bad spell. And they react, by making changes and things like that, where I think we've always seen, especially at United, you know, the stability and what that brings is absolutely crucial, absolutely vital. We've seen it more and more in football now. You know, managers losing a job after 50 days in charge is absolutely, it's criminal, it really is.
We're coming towards the end of the time now. You mentioned United, and we're going to talk about some other things you're doing. But what have you made of United this season? Is David Moyes the right man to take the club forward? Fans have been pretty behind him so far, but I sense that opinions are starting to change a little bit.
I don't think there's any question he's the right man. I think he is. There's no doubt about it. Again, it's going to take time. You know, I think that in 27 years of having the same manager, all of a sudden somebody comes in and has got to change his philosophy, not so much change his philosophy, but he's got to put his own stamp on the club. Can't just be a continuum of what's been going on before. Things are going to take time. You've got to bring your own players in, you've got to set your own mark, your own standards and things like that. And you know, you've got to remember that the manager, Sir Alex, played a massive part in bringing David in as well. So you look at his 27 years, he didn't get many things wrong. He'll not get this wrong, but it will take time. You know, it has to. And on the other side of that, you've got to think that, you know, Man City, Villa's very, very strong team. Chelsea, very, very strong team. You know, Liverpool brought in an outstanding manager as well in Brendan Rodgers. You know, standards are getting driven up, and it can only be good for football. Man United, seventh in the league at the minute. You know, they've got to drive the standards up again. They've, you know, set the standards, get to the standards that they've been setting for the last 20 years.
But it's not happening. How much time should a manager be given? A couple of years? Should fans be thinking in years rather than months? Because fans have, throughout the season, expected a good run of form to come. And United have been stubborn in 7th or 8th. And if you look at the results this calendar year, it's getting worse.
Yeah, like I say, it will take time. It has got to be years. It can't be months. Yeah. There's no point. You know, it's got to be a settling in process for the manager, for the staff, for the players even, for everybody involved at the club. So there's no point making knee-jerk reactions. And in all fairness, Man United have had unrivalled success for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And if there's no success for this year, then as harsh as it's to say, so be it.
Yeah. It's like being a normal football fan.
Yeah, but if that means that it's the start of the process for the next 10, 15, 20 years to be successful, then I'm sure you'd accept that. So, you know, there's always going to be a transition. And you look at the goal yesterday. I mean, on Sunday. You know, it was United dominated for, you know, 80. I think it was 80-20 in possession or something like that. You know, you got chance after chance, and then Fulham go and get a goal out of nowhere, and it's, you know, bit of a disaster, really. It was a poor goal to give away. There's no question about that. But you know, it's little things like that. They probably just need to tidy up. But you know, that will change. You know, it's the captain wants away and whatever, for whatever reason. Fine, it's Manchester United. No one's bigger than the club. You deal with that, and then you bring the next one in. So you know, it will evolve. There's no doubt about it. Man United, you know, for the last 60 years, 70 years since Matt Busby came into the club in 1938 and started developing the youth system. You know, that's been an ongoing thing, and it will always continue to do that.
I find the whole Vidic thing strange, because I get information from the club that he's not been happy and he wants out. The way the announcement went out at midnight on a Thursday, it's clear that a lot of players, there's issues with several players. Is that just for the manager to be given the power and to deal with it? If you've got some, you know, senior pros who aren't happy with the lot, it's difficult to deal with, but is that something the manager just has to do?
Yeah, you take it back to 95, yeah, when the manager moved on three big players. I mean, there were big players for Manchester United back then. Mark Hughes, Paul Ince and Andrei Kanchelskis. I moved them on for probably different reasons for each one of them.
Yeah.
But they were big players, and you do the same again.
Yeah.
And because Manchester United will, you know, it'll always evolve. It'll always sort the situation out. It has to. Mm. You know, it's that big a club. So whoever wants to leave, fine.
Yeah.
You know, throughout the last 20 years, players have always left, but they've been replaced, and they'll continue to do that. Mm. So if Vidic wants to leave, then, you know, he's not going to, I'm sure, you know, David Moyes has got a problem with having to replace him, but there are players who can replace him, there's no question about that. So, but if he wants to leave, not leave it, lose any sleep about it, that's life. He'll deal with that and move on to the next player.
Yeah. You're training for the London Marathon, I believe.
Yeah, don't remind me. It's been a long, I would say, couple of years, really. I trained for it last year. And did the marathon in last year in April, but leading up to it, I injured my knee and wasn't as fit as I'd like to have been going into the race, and it was okay, 3:51, but probably underachieved a little bit from where I wanted to get to. I put an awful lot of work into it, and literally, you know, a couple of hours later after crossing the line, I decided I wanted to do it again, and I had a week's rest and then started to train for it again. But I trained differently this time. I trained a lot higher intensities and really changed my training around, I'm doing it for the Bodymore Cancer Fund.
Why are you doing it for the Cancer Fund?
It's a charity that's close to my heart. Bobby Moore died of bowel cancer, which my mum died of 2.5 years ago, and it's a dreadful thing, especially in young men or men between the 30s and 60s. It can be really a devastating illness, something we've got to raise awareness of, so I want to do that and raise as much money as possible. I spoke to Bobby's wife on Friday. We're meeting next week to go about how we're going to best raise some money, but I'm sure people if listening to this can help and contribute, then be very, very grateful. Obviously with the World Cup year is as well, and as soon as you mention Bobby Moore, that image of him in his red England shirt lifting the World Cup will resonate with a lot of people. It's something, like I said, that's really close to me, and really something that I want to drive forward and hopefully, like I say, raise a lot of money for.
Mike Dobbin was probably Manchester United's greatest ever supporter. He died 5 years ago. The anniversary was a couple of weeks ago. And I'm pretty certain it was bowel cancer. Mike was the type of fella who, if Manchester United played a pre-season game in Johannesburg and played the next day a United 11 in Oxford, he'd be at both games. And he dedicated his life to it. So I think the cause is a very good one. I'm sure everyone listening will have been touched by cancer in some shape or form. How would we contribute to help with your fundraising? Have you got a Just Giving account?
That's something I'll set up with the charity next week. Okay. So if I can let you know about that further down the line, I'll definitely do that. So
that's fine, and we'll make sure that United We Stand readers know about that. So you're aiming for 220, yeah?
Aiming for what, sorry?
2 hours, 20 minutes in a marathon.
2 hours, 20 minutes? Well, no. If I was, I'd be one of the elite athletes. I'm hopefully, well, anything around about between 3 hours and 3 hours 40 this time. It's, like I say, 3 hours 51 was hard as well, I've got to say. It was a tough run. I ran it for children with cancer last year and raised over £3,000 for them, which was a, again, really rewarding experience for me. So if I can get anywhere near that this year, be really happy. But I think this is going to be something that's going to be, ongoing as well with the Bobby Moore Fund as well.
Brilliant. If the class of 92 ran that marathon with you, who do you think could win it? Because Gary Neville said it'd easily be him.
What, easily be him? What, have you seen the size of him now? No, I've tried to get him to run it, but he's not having it. Phil looks like he keeps himself pretty fit. Obviously, Giggsy can. Giggsy's kept himself fit. Scholesy wouldn't. I don't think he wouldn't have much chance. Not with his asthma and all that. So I think, Giggsy probably have a good stab at it. But I don't. It is a different kind of training. There's no question. It's some of the winter days where and the evenings where you're out, plodding away for 2 or 3 hours, it can be quite lonely out there at times, and it's a different kind of fitness.
Good luck, and thanks for your time.
Much.
So that's it from Chris. Hope you enjoyed that. There's no game this weekend. United are in Dubai, where they're on a training camp, warm weather training camp. Hopefully to get their heads together. Hopefully to find some strength, some positivity from somewhere ahead of the run of games, which is coming, including return to the Champions League. We'll be bringing you a podcast from Olympiacos in a couple of weeks' time. But until next week, for the next podcast, goodbye.